I would like to look at you with sad, betrayed, doughy eyes and do my best Tucker Carlson impression and say, what's going on?
I'd like to look back at you with a jaundiced eye, with a gimlet eye, and say, who fucking knows? What is going on?
Yeah, the point of asking that question usually isn't to answer it. It's
right,
just,
yeah.
You fill in the blank. It's like, oh, the Jews, of course.
Or yeah.
You know, it's a very, you know, fill in the blank. Who's your scapegoat?
Is that Tucker Carlson's like modus operandi these days? I haven't been watching a lot of Tucker, I'll be honest.
Well, he would classically during the Biden years just point to signs of wokeness or, you know, question official narratives and say, what's going on?
What's going on?
And but now
that furrowed brow, that famously furrowed brow he had.
But now his people are in power. He was at the White House this week wearing a gigantic, stupid-looking MAGA hat.
He should wear
one. And so now it's our chance to say what's going on.
He should wear one of those like little pinwheel hats, you know, the kind that little kids wear. Is he an internal critic of MAGA, or is he just like I honestly don't know. I don't really pay much attention to him. He's like a content producer for them, like a house intellectual for MAGA.
One thing he said that was kind of illuminating in there was like the lawsuit against Fox News by the voting machine company.
Right.
And in the discovery, there were text messages from him. And one thing he said is that Trump is a destroyer. He's going to destroy everything, but he's not going to destroy us.
That is a very interesting sentiment. I feel like a lot of people are banking on that.
Right.
And Trump is a destroyer. He's right about that. We're watching the destruction happen in real time. Think if you work for the federal bureaucracy, you're not dodging the destruction. Not from what we've seen so far.
I think probably a lot of them have the same attitude. That's like, we're fucked, but we're going to try to hang on to our jobs. You know, I think the question of hang on to this era of the, I don't know, post-New Deal bureaucracy is a lost cause. But people do want to hang on to their jobs as best they can. And for a lot of them, it's going to mean proving loyalty, and a lot of them are kind of probably know their days are numbered and are going to have to fight their way out.
I think a lot of people aren't used to, especially not in that realm, aren't used to fighting for their jobs.
No.
That's going to come as like a great surprise, I think. That's part of like the shock and awe of this whole campaign, right? Is these people have been tied into this like these funding streams and these congressionally delegated power streams. And it seemed like, you know, whether you're an AFL-CIO official or whether you're just like a rank-and-file federal worker, that this was going to continue forever. Lo and behold, here arrives Musk and his legion of like 19 and 20-year-old fucking mushroom-haircutted Gen Z psychopath-like children.
Yeah, the situation is not bussing.
No cap. Like, you would have to sit down in front of like a 19-year-old, you're like a 60-year-old seasoned Washington bureaucrat. Like, you've been working deep in the trenches of the Treasury Department, sending out like trillion-dollar payments to various peoples for decades, you know, and you do your little job inside of the federal bureaucracy, and one day you have to sit down across from a 19-year-old child.
And he says, what the Sigma?
What? He says,
and you have to, sir, I do not know what Sigma means.
Except that's a wrong answer in and of itself, and you've just lost your job.
Yeah,
you've now like officially resigned because you don't.
There's going to be a memo circulating of the Zoomer slang that you have to know to keep your job.
They'll like the resistance the Democrats will put up is hiring outside like Gen Z consultants hired by the Democratic Party to like school all the old school bureaucrats in the federal bureaucracy about Gen Z slang so they can pass their interviews and justify their jobs and continue. That's the best. Is setting up a new consulting class is like the best the Democrats could do under these situations.
Easier than learning Mandarin.
Hamilton, that's coming for all of us. Hamilton Nolan
has a good piece about the Hamilton Nolan has a good piece about this called Dark Times Are Coming, about the what's facing labor these next 4 years.
Do you remember when we had him on at the Majority Report studios and the only mic that was recording was like the internal mic for one of the desktops there.
You know, I don't remember because I was not there that day, which is probably why that
happened.
Yes.
That was also like our seventh episode. I think I saw Hamilton Nolan as like a get because he was you know, he is. He's like the chapel left, like millennial labor guy.
Yeah. So, yeah, I'll put this article in the show notes. It's very good. And a big part of it is about the public sector unions, which I've seen some people like looking for some hope of resistance this last week, pointing to the Department of Labor blocking Musk from coming in. You know, the public sector workers in general kind of being defiant in some way, trying to slow down this takeover from the Doge cadre.
Yeah,
he writes,
if you piss against the tide hard enough, maybe you'll turn it back.
He writes, government workers, in one sense, the public sector is the heart of American union power, since about a third of public sector workers are union members and less than 6% of private sector workers are. But these public sector unions, are they prepared for what's coming? I would love to say yes, but I see little evidence of that. These unions are legalistic, bureaucratic, political entities, some more than others. They primarily exercise power by aligning themselves with friendly politicians, pushing legislation, filing lawsuits, and bargaining and enforcing contracts. You will notice that none of those tactics are going to be very effective in the current moment. The friendly politicians are out of power, the regulatory agencies are being dismantled, and the courts are captured by the right wing. You are about to watch the unions that represent federal government employees be steamrolled because they have built themselves to center their power in the law rather than in the power to strike.
I think we've been saying similar things for years, right? Like, sure. but there was no reason to ever think that what we have to say would be useful about, you know, practically, politically, it would be useful. But it turns out, at least in the negative sense, it is. I think Hamilton Nolan's exactly right about this. I would go one step further and say that, like, these public sector unions, these federal unions, these unions that were not included as part of like the New Deal bargain were in fact a product of the 1960s and 1970s and the great social and workers' struggles that arose during those periods. In the quiescence of the last 50, 60, 70 years of the union movement, the federal worker unions like present themselves to the quote-unquote labor movement as like a free gift, as like a guaranteed gift, like by the state, like billions of dollars worth of dues, which are like basically transferred in a very real sense from the federal budget through to these workers, through to the dues, as like a guaranteed power center, an inert one, of course, very inert for the reasons that Hamilton Nolan talks about, but a very real power center for what's left of the labor movement, or at least let's say the labor bureaucracy. So to see those under threat now, more so than anything, more so than even the perpetual back and forth at the National Labor Relations Board, maybe as much of a threat as both Elon Musk and Jeff Bezos like coming at the NLRA as unconstitutional, is that like this large reservoir of dues and power that the existing labor movement has is now being torn from it and torn asunder. Can they survive without the billions of dollars of dues, without this sort of like state mandated sector where they could survive and thrive even under adverse circumstances? Will it survive this? I don't know. What do you think?
Well, I think we're in a moment where on one hand we traditionally believed, you know, whether you're a leftist or not, that the purpose of the state is if you're a leftist, you'd say it's a bourgeois dictatorship. If you're a rightist or whatever, you might think that it's a deep state dictatorship or something. But either way, the point of it is the same. It's the stability of the American empire and its ability to make profit and reproduce itself,
right?
You know, and do well for its shareholders.
Right.
So yeah, in this moment when we're like looking at maybe the bottom dropping out on that stability in the process of this radical restructuring that Musk is taking, much as he restructured Twitter, where he's trying to fire as many people as possible as a means to streamlining it in a different way with less employees, obviously less regulation, but keeping the money flowing. But also the question is, will it be flowing to this emerging techno-capitalist financial sect, this faction sort of guided by this like neo-reaction Yarvinist line of thought, is trying to become the vanguard of both the productive bourgeoisie and the financial bourgeoisie and merging them into one acts the everything bourgeois entity. And
that's the political movement, right? Is the everything app.
Right. And yeah. by proxy, the entire state will sort of run in the way that an app runs, where you can, you know, do payments and you can also like set the agenda politically. And so
you can control both like the Treasury Department's like money dispersal, where like trillions of dollars are going out all at once, and you can also control like the federal bureaucrats by like scaring the shit out of them and making them anti-woke all of a sudden, right? It's the everything app for ideology. It's great.
I think the question we're all asking ourselves, though, is that how when we react to this, when we watch it, how much of it is Trump derangement syndrome, right? Because we remember the first administration where we felt the exact same way that we feel now, but things remained fundamentally the same, right?
Yeah,
like regulation was stripped away, and you know the border regime became more militaristic and cruel and stuff like that. But the kind of the way the empire worked remained functionally the same. Trump handed it off to Biden. Biden continued to do largely the same things.
Yeah.
And now it's handed it back to Trump. And it doesn't seem like Trump has changed at all. But the people he's put in are more militant about a radical restructuring, which we've really needed since 2008.
Yeah. I mean, this is John Gantz's thesis, right, in this piece that I'm sure you'll post in the show notes. That like what has changed is now there's like a tech right, you know, that Elon Musk is sort of the vanguard of. I think a lot of things have changed. I think you say Trump hasn't changed. I feel like Trump has changed, and also the Democrats have changed too. The Democrats broadly. Trump has changed in that like citizen Trump, you know, this non-politician that came in 2016 was not prepared for the resistance that he was going to face. He wasn't prepared for, like, he was prepared to make deals, but he didn't understand that, like, making deals in Washington is different from making deals in, like, Scotland for a golf course, or Mar-a-Lago for a golf course, or, like, Saudi Arabia for a golf course. Like, the types of deals that needed to be made in government operate by different principles, different stakeholders or whatever. I think that Trump has learned a lot of lessons. I think we're not looking as much at citizen Trump anymore as we're looking at like politician Trump. And I think that for himself and for MAGA and his people, I think they've very much clarified what they understand the enemy to be, their enemy to be. And it took 4 years of failure in office for them to realize that Trump's campaign of retribution, you know, we're seeing it happen in real time. His retribution wasn't something that, you know, Joe Biden could protect everybody by, what is it, like preemptively giving them immunity by pardoning them of any sins they might have committed, like his son over the last 8 or 10 years or whatever, or like vast swaths of the federal bureaucracy give them like preemptive pardons against Donald Trump. The rod is like way deeper than that. And we are not the same either, I would argue. I don't think I'm the same as I was 8 years ago. I don't think you are. And certainly the way that the, let's call it the political establishment has reacted to the return of Trump, not the accidental first administration where it seemed as though either Russian interference or like the quirks of the Electoral College system made an illegitimate guy the president of the United States. There's like the imprimatur of legitimacy here, and there's like the imprimatur of 8 years, as you said, of Biden largely following a lot of Trump's policies. That's given like a gravitas to this second term that maybe he didn't have before. Not for us. I think I, like you, see Trump as symptomatic, MAGA as symptomatic, but also would much rather be ruled. If I'm going to be ruled by like a middle class faction allied with some sectors of capital, I like it to be like the nice one, you know, like the woke one. I'd like it to be the one that like went to college at Brown instead of like, you know, opened up a jet ski dealership outside of Wichita, Kansas. You know, I'd like it for it to be like the nice middle class faction, but it's not. And we all need to confront that.
Yeah. So something Gams gets into in this article.
This is my first Gans I've ever read. What's it called again? It's called What Happened? What happened here? What the fuck?
Yeah.
Happened?
Something he gets into is, I think he puts it pretty well, is something we've been talking about this show since we started, basically, and like one of our first feuds with the Amy Therese podcast about wokeness. You know, wokeness back then was kind of, it was something that was a term that had emerged out of the Trumpist reaction to Black Lives Matter, to the queer and trans civil rights movements, and sort of became the new, before that it was social justice warriors,
political correctness,
and then it transferred just to, yeah, and political correctness before that, and it became now the sort of bludgeon with which this restructuring is taking place. So it's kind of interesting to see this sort of marginal internecine disagreement on the left and like this scapegoat of the right of, you know, bounding liberalism and the left together in order to crush both become the sort of revolutionary watchword of this neo-reaction vanguard's seizure of full power. And we're watching how far it's going to go. And Gans does a good job of explaining how people like Andreessen and David Sacks and Musk use this term to explicitly refer to not just the deep state, but just the intellectuals in general, like the people who government workers or not, see that the function of government is to not only reproduce things technocratically, but have some kind of moral, vision of doing it. Mm-hmm. And Musk is basically saying, like, no more morality, only technocracy. Yeah. And we have a new technocratic vision of how to do this, and feeding people and vaccinating people and making sure hiring is fair and all of these questions of justice are now banished.
What was it that Sam Altman came out and said recently is that, like, with the rise of new technologies, the social contract is going to necessarily have to change. Yeah. This is the changing of the social contract. You're right. Like, it's interesting to interrogate maybe this, like, moral imperative at the center of progressivism, right? Which is to say at the center of the state, right? And what the state is meant to do in order to, like, create a good society. It's really what we're seeing now is like what we could see as like the amoral or technocratic thrust of the Elon Musks and Andreessens and Thiels of the world is a different morality. You know, it's like a different thrust. It's a different vision of what a good society will be. Like, wokeness in a real sense is like a compound word that means a lot of things, but it's also a god that's failed. You know, it's failed on its own terms over the last 10 years if we've watched it fail. The idea that you can reinvigorate a meritocracy in this country, or like a legitimacy for the economy, a raison d'etre for the state by like this sort of progressive integration of new and disparate coalitions into like the middle class, using college education, using HR departments, using like
civil rights,
you know, newfangled technologies of power, like white fragility, that Robin DiAngelo person, like that you could use all these different means to like ensure the legitimacy of capital accumulation and the legitimacy of the state as like that which stands in between like capital and like the ruin of society, that on its own terms failed. Like, we watched it fail in real time. You know, we started our podcast 3, 4, 5, 6 years after Gamergate.
It failed because it didn't maintain the legitimacy. Is that what you're saying?
It failed because it didn't maintain the legitimacy.
Right. And I think
it attempted to, and it had means to do so, but the rise of the tech right is an expression of its failure, is that it couldn't actually be like, it didn't have the integrative functions that like some like the progressive faction of the middle class technocracy thought it might have as like legitimizing the entire profit system.
And it failed to put Trump and Musk and these people in prison or
absolutely
like shut them out with whatever means they had.
It failed to give Hamilton Nolan a new labor movement to write about. We were meant to like under Obama have like and under Bernie Sanders have like a new and vibrant labor movement, which was going to like integrate like what we I guess would call the PMC with like the older labor movement, and that was supposed to be the Obama coalition, which was supposed to last for 100 years. It was going to be a 1,000-year Reich, you know. But we watched this fail in front of us, you know, over the last 15 years.
But it did, and so I think the failure of the Democratic Party in this moment is really the failure of them representing the legitimacy of government. And when Trump was first elected, there was a big movement to defend the legitimacy of their vision of government against his sort of vandalist impulses.
Yeah.
And, you know, 4 years later, Biden won exactly on that platform. But 4 years after that, people are sick of the government again. And the Democrats run on that platform again of like, we're going to keep this sort of regime in place. People said, no, fuck it. We don't want it anymore.
They don't want it. It's not a persuasive vision either for like what was lost was like the working class component of that. Right. There has been, as Gantz points out, like fractions of capital, especially tech capital, which have given up on this vision. Very evocative quotation from Mark Andreessen in there about how, you know, starting about 15 years ago, like all these Tumblr kids started working for their companies and like share, like meetings of employees would be like struggle sessions, Maoist struggle sessions. And these kids wanted to like overturn their whole system. And that explains like his sort of turn towards Trump as his workers became unmanageable. Their demands for like inclusivity, their demands for like Andreessen's Silicon Valley capitalist corporations to not be capitalist anymore became too much. And you needed to have this backlash to this backlash in order to like set Silicon Valley's ideology on a new basis. Because like the progressive sort of like technocratic California ideology of the Clinton into the Obama years was basically outstripped by the demands that society was placing on Silicon Valley as like the last profit center left to the United States. You know, like these things, it's fun to talk about these things in ideological terms or political terms, but let's bring it back to the material terms. And like the stakes for Silicon Valley and the stakes for America right now are really fucking high. Like, let's not forget that, just a week or so ago that the DeepSeek AI thing happened and put the whole NVIDIA Magnificent Seven Silicon Valley profit center in question as like billions and trillions of dollars are put into AI. It looks like China might be doing it better than us, much cheaper.
Did you see Trump's response to that? It was great.
No, what'd he say?
He was like, yeah, this is good. It means we can do this AI stuff cheaper.
Oh, there you go. Thinking outside the box.
Yeah, exactly.
That's like... That's, I think, what separates maybe like good faith and interesting observers from like of nowadays from maybe even ourselves 8 years ago is like we could all recognize Trump the destroyer now. Like, we don't want him to destroy what he's destroying, but we understand that this is like a project of destruction, probably creative of something new. Something that we need to take seriously, not something we could just blow off like we did 8 years ago. Like, consider this political vandalism. Instead, the way I would encourage us to look at it, the way I've been trying to look at it, is more dispassionate or scientifically, as hard as that is, given all the things that are happening right now, to understand that this is a moment where like something new is being born, whether we like it or not.
Yeah, you have to do that. We have to be partisan in this moment.
Sure.
And it's become incredibly obvious that partisanship to the Democratic Party meant partisanship to the way they mediated a legitimation of the left and the leftism and progressivism and civil rights as a project of legitimizing the government. And that's what the failure is. But that is not a failure of wokeness.
Exactly. No,
because wokeness is not simply just a bank becoming gay 1 week a year. It's a historical movement that stretches back to the Enlightenment and its conflict with the Jacobites, the wide awakes and their conflict with the know-nothings.
So SDS
and the silent majority.
Yeah.
Being woke means literally awakening to the truth that the bourgeoisie and their political parties and their white supremacist coalition with the working class do not deserve to exist and maintain their power. And our failure on that regard is it's not a movement armed to take power itself. It has relied on an intellectual class to translate that into government functionality, and they're the ones that failed.
Mm-hmm.
So I think we should still be partisans of woke.
Mm.
We maybe should use a different term now, but we're still partisans of the Enlightenment. And
yes,
of
that's true,
abolition.
Yeah. Yeah.
And of a democratic society.
Universalist principles. Absolutely.
Yes, yeah.
Universalist versus the particular. For sure. I think there's a different way to frame this partisanship, right? Like, we could frame it, as you say, like towards some like abstraction of like some, not transhistorical, but like some sort of universalist sentiment going back to the beginning of the Enlightenment, which I think is valid. I think is very much valid. And I think that, like, the Marxist project or the communist project can only really be understood in those terms. Whether, like, wokeness in its whole is, like, encompassed by that, I think it is good to, like, put a pin down and say, like, the universalist aspects of what we would call wokeism are worth defending. And I think that they do. If you want to talk about partisanship, about being partisan, I think we should be partisan. But I think the way to look at the battles that are happening right now is to go back to that old adage we have where, you know, the state is the dictatorship of the haute bourgeoisie and it's the dictatorship over the working class, but it truly is a democracy for the middle class, right? And so what we're seeing now is a battle, and why some of us, I think, can stand back and watch it happen a little bit, you know, or at least be like dispassionate and critical about it from a bit of a distance, if we're able to, is because there's a battle within the middle class, the American middle class, over what the future of the class system is going to look like, the future of what democracy and politics is going to look like, whether the legitimation of the profit system is going to happen through like raw laissez-faire nationalistic means, or whether it's going to happen by like tempered, nice cosmopolitan, sort of like professional managerial means. This battle is a real one, and there are real stakes in it. It's just for the working class itself, for the people who, like the rank and file, who are buffeted by these winds thrown at them by politics. The people that I'm working with, as I'm back to work now, who just kind of keep their heads down and just try to like make a buck and pay their rent, pay their mortgage, whatever it is, and try to survive under dire circumstances. This is a battle between like two factions outside of ourselves, but also factions that express something important about society. And so what we should be partisans for, I think, is like not the progressive liberals of the Democratic Party and part of the Republican Party, not the psycho conservative liberals of like this new emergent MAGA thing, but instead be partisan for the class, to the class, you know, the working class, which there are real stakes for this, but like the working class isn't aligned with either of these broadly.
I would say that they are, but ultimately they're not. And this is the message
ultimately,
of Marxism.
Not even that they're not, but that they shouldn't, right? They shouldn't be.
Right.
This should be our mystery. We should not align ourselves with either.
And Gans has a great 18th Brumaire quote in his piece that sort of expresses why this Musk offensive is an anti-socialistic offensive. So this is a quote from 18th Brumaire. "It is understood that all the so-called bourgeois liberties and organs of progress attacked and menaced its class rule as its social foundation and at its political summit simultaneously, and had therefore become socialistic. In this menace and in this attack, it rightly discerned the secret of socialism, whose import and tendency it judges more correctly than the so-called socialism knows how to judge itself.
Mm.
So he knows that wokeness is socialist, but we don't. another important message, not from 18th Brumaire, but from... it is from 18th Brumaire, is that the birth of socialism was this cross-class coalition that was initially very popular, but... Between 1848 and 18th Brumaire, that coalition breaks down.
Uh-huh.
All the other classes betray the working class.
Right.
And as he famously states, the working class stands alone. So, yeah. The working class did its best to form this legislative political coalition.
With the liberalizing bourgeoisie, mm-hmm. and with the
and
small farmers.
Yeah. Ultimately, they were betrayed by everyone, and only the people who started this whole phase of struggle by building barricades in the street of Paris were the ones that remained true to this socialism.
Mm-hmm.
And so the message of that is not to be like optimistic that the working class is going to do the right thing in the right moment, but only that the working class is the sort of motor of this struggle.
Mm-hmm.
And it's where the next phase of revolution against liberalism will come from.
Yeah. I've written some stuff here in the notes, so I'll just go ahead and read what I've got and kind of how I feel about this moment. You know, I tweeted about this and I said, like, now is the time to wait and watch and learn, because the things that the bourgeoisie is throwing up, the things that Trump is throwing up, like the conservative liberals are throwing up, these are the conditions that we're going to be living within and fighting within for the next 40 or 50 years. And then some bright person threw up the comment on that, like, what if we don't have 40 or 50 years? Like, we'll all be dead and boiled by that point. And I said, problem is, what if we're not? Problem is, what if, like, despite all of our protestations, this isn't the end? That, like, regardless of what happens with the environment, maybe there's some silver bullet out there. Maybe adaptation is just the way that the capitalist class is going to force us to deal with these terrible circumstances. What if we have to live another 40 or 50 years on this planet? Like, what if we have to survive and actually have to fight? Because it's really nice to, like, lay down and die. And that's what, like, the Democratic Party has chosen to do under this. But I'm not sure any of us really have that option.
We all have that option.
We have that option.
But, that's... We've always had that option, and the more realistic answer is we are going to have to continue living, and if we have children, we have to consider what kind of world we want them to live in. And I think the reason the billionaires are so fired up right now is a lot of them have a bunch of kids, and they want them to be the new aristocracy of, like, a new ex-world order.
Yeah.
And so they're planning for a dystopian future. We both agree that we're headed towards a dystopian future.
Yeah.
And they're using their power to ensure that they are safely protected within these techno-fascist city-states.
So it's going to be like Baron Trump is going to be like the political expression of this new order. And then Musk and Grimes, their child named like XAE.
Children. They have three kids.
Three kids together. Their kid named like XAE, like ampersand, cosine, whatever, is going to be the economic expression maybe of this power. So, like, I find myself in all of this mess feeling pretty bloodless. Feeling pretty dispassionate, trying to, like, get my head around it. Because in a certain way, this, what we're living through right now, this MAGA revolution, this bloodless revolution, seems like it's necessary. It's not necessary for humanity. It's not necessary for the left. It's not necessary for the working class. It's necessary for capital.
Mm-hmm.
So not in, like, a humanistic sense, in, like, an anti-humanistic sense, it appears as though something like Trump is necessary to, like, clear out the clutter of the last 50 to 100 years, and where the rest of us are just sort of along for the ride.
Mm-hmm. We're in the way.
We're in the way,
Do you think that Musk and Trump, we are talking about it like they have a plan, and, like, certainly they have a vision that includes, like, building colonies on Mars, and if not Mars, on Greenland or whatever.
Right. Panama.
They have these visions, but do they really have a plan, or are they just sort of kind of motivated by their dark lord capital, just smashing things up, clear away the Chinese walls, and make sure that their people can try to capitalism their way out of this.
I think the plan is to capitalism your way out of it, for sure. I think that that appears as a magic bullet for them because that's all they know, you know, as capitalists. Like, these are, they pull the levers that are in front of them. I think that, that broadly they've got like a vision. But like, I feel like their vision is circumscribed by the fact that like they can only understand it as like a negative vision of like an enemy that needs to be destroyed, like a deep state that needs to be confronted, like a USAID and NLRB that need to be overthrown to like to elicit like the animal spirits of capitalism, to like bring together like the necessary human and technical material to make it to Mars. You need to clear away this muck and mire, which isn't in itself like the necessary product of capitalism, which is what the progressive state is, right? It's like a necessary product of like the conflicts which could not be overcome through workers' socialism, had to be overcome by like this retrograde progressive system of like managing the contradictions, right? They don't see it that way. They simply see like the state as this impediment to their rule. They see like progressivism, the cathedral, what else do they call it, turning the frogs gay, the deep state. They see all these things as like an impediment, where if you simply swept them aside, free markets and commerce and like stick-to-itiveness and the human spirit will like bring us along. And of course, not realizing that like progressivism itself is, has been a response to like very real problems posed by capitalist society. And in doing this, they're going to create a whole series of other problems, probably worse problems than they're actually seeking to solve. But I think that the inherent like negative quality of their vision is really interesting, because the enemies that they've identified for themselves are ones that we maybe like fish don't recognize what water is because it's just all around them, didn't even recognize as like as enemies or even recognize that they exist. The fact that when they get into the files of USAID and we realize that like, of course, Democrats and like the left wing of the Republicans want to defend the humanitarian aid and like the HIV and vaccine work that USAID does. Sure, like we should all, somebody should do that, right? What we didn't realize, and it took them opening the books, is that the USAID is a humongous slush fund for like retired politicians, for like party activists.
I don't think that was ever a secret.
Yeah, but it wasn't like, it didn't confront us in the way it did when you see the actual receipts, when you see like all the ways in which party activists are basically like kept in these like sinecures, in these like nice little jobs, and then activated like when time comes, when election time comes, or when George Floyd gets murdered by the police. You've got a real apparatus there. I wouldn't call it the cathedral. I'm not dumb like Curtis Yarvin is, or dumb like Elon Musk is. I'm dumb in a different way. I see it as like, maybe for the first time in their like negative appraisal of it, I can understand why they see it as an impediment. And I can understand the way in which socialists might also see the same thing as an impediment, but for different reasons. And I think this, there's like a mapping of power that's happening right now as we watch what they run up against that like we can use fruitfully for our own tasks.
Well, yeah, we can and we must, because...
But we're not. But,
you know, what is... So two sort of forces are forced to confront this strategy of slashing and burning things like USAID, even the CIA and
these
other agencies that they're coming after and trying to downsize or restructure. The first is that USAID is not simply a giveaway to cronies, it's or even a humanitarian giveaway to starving or sick people around the world. It's also a necessary part of how the United States economy functions, both as a hegemon and internally. So, for example, a lot of farm lobbies are sounding the alarm that, you know, a lot of the food we grow is bought by USAID to be shipped out overseas. Right. And our whole business model is based on this. And so you're kind of going to fuck over a lot of the agribusiness.
Right. That's a hidden, like, people. And like, maybe you and I knew, because we've looked into the New Deal or whatever, that like SNAP benefits, part of the reaction of like food stamps was a way to like stabilize farm prices and stabilize mm-hmm. like big agribusiness and ensure that they
burgers could, for all, as we'll talk about with as Phil we'll Neal talk about week.
Exactly. Like maybe we knew that in an abstract sense, but like now things are becoming very, very clear. As you said, like we see the role that USAID and the billions of dollars of food that the federal government buys to send abroad, how that affects the broader economy. You know, like maybe this isn't the way that like we wanted this education to happen. Certainly not the way that farmers wanted it to, but the chaos that it's causing might be for us a productive one. You're going to talk about the different ways to confront this, but maybe it's a productive chaos.
So that was, yeah, I was saying that was the first force that they could unleash, which is economic crisis, a new sort of depression, as the industries that are based on government funding and government functionality begin to fail. A second and more important to our interest is the masses, because part of this social contract is that the masses are able to find some sort of representation in this government structure, where they increasingly don't find it in politicians. They can find it in their unions lobbying within the state, asking the NLRB for some relief, asking for some stability. So when you have a large amount of people struggling to make ends meet, we can say like, well, we actually do have to raise wages here so people can pay rent and keep fucking working. And it, with that taken away, we've already seen a massive amount of homelessness in the last 8 years, really booming during the Biden administration. And that's a symbol of the lower rungs of the working class increasingly being thrown into the reserve army of surplus population. And so the Musk vision of this is the same as Israel's vision. Well, fuck those people. Surveil them, put them into sort of territorial prisons, and when they rise up, just fucking murder them all and destroy everything. And who gives a fuck about them anymore?
It's more so even than that, too. It's like similar to we thought, or at least I thought a year and change ago, 15 months ago, that Hamas and Netanyahu were continuing to play the same game that they were for the last like 30 years or so, keeping some sort of stability to the relationship between Israelis and Palestinians, when it turns out that October 7th on the part of Hamas was like a desperate move to keep history from overcoming their entire movement. And Netanyahu and his right-wing coalition's reaction actually was for a final solution to this problem. And it took us months and months to realize that both parties here were not looking to like return to some status quo, but instead were choosing radical options. Bibi's was genocide, which is why we've slowly seen under Biden and Harris like a drift towards ethnic cleansing and genocide. One of the reasons is that like these more and more sectors of the ruling class are being radicalized towards final solutions to problems. If you take the bleeding edge of the tech right, I suppose we call it now, and how they understand this moment and exactly the dynamic you're talking about, is that the white collar workers, the people who have been working in logistics or accounts receivable for USAID for the last 20, 30, 40 years, as Homan or Hobart, whatever his name is, and ICE deports millions upon millions of like fruit picking migrant workers, like quote unquote illegal workers, that those white collar workers fired from the federal government will all of a sudden have new employment opportunities. It's just that they're going to be picking raspberries for like, you know, $2 an hour.
And they're going to suck at it.
But they're going to learn and they're going to pull themselves up by their bootstraps. And as Musk said to them, they'll have the opportunity to do something productive with their lives. Yep. Productive for capital, productive for agricultural capital, industrial capital, whatever it is. So the radicality of that vision, the radicalism of that vision.
Going back to the countryside type.
Yeah. Like capital is sending the bureaucrats back to the countryside. Uh-huh. A societal movement like that, like the Great Proletarian Cultural Revolution, is just happening in ways that like are bureaucratic and like weird because of the type of society that we live in. Bureaucratic and weird, and maybe the ways that the Chinese state wasn't in the 1960s, but just as bureaucratic and just as fucking weird. So I think maybe in this time of churn, like all we can really do is like try to pick up some of these threads, try to see what threads they're pulling on and try to like hope that someday in a few years when the fallout, you know, because Trump's got what, reasonably like 2 years, less than that before the courts start pushing back, but certainly 2 years before like Congress has a new election, the House has a new election, and you've got like maybe finally some pushback from Democrats. A lot could happen in 2 years, and it might take us 20 years to figure out the ramifications of all the changes that are happening right now is like agency after agency is thrown into the fucking wood chipper.
Right. And they will have to find some way to prevent, you know, they can brush the old forces of the deep state, but the function of what the state exists to do is going to be a limit. Because, for example, yeah, you can starve a bunch of people, including U.S. farmers, by slashing U.S. aid, but if you break the payment system to, for example, the U.S. Army,
right,
and people stop, like generals stop getting their checks, you know, you are fucking with people who have a lot of guns.
Yeah. and the final say on whether or not your power is legitimate or not.
And so I think the judiciary, for example, you know, we're in a moment as we record right now where a judge has blocked some of the access that Musk has over to Treasury information. And the way they're responding to this is, okay, Congress, impeach this judge. And we're going to see if they do it.
Yeah.
But that can only go so far to the point where either the judiciary or finally the army has to decide how far they want to go with this restructuring. And they're not going to continue doing it if they're not being paid. And if they're not seeing, or, you know, we're seeing a better example is probably the stock market has been fairly stable these first few weeks. And if we start to see that really crash, that's going to sort of change what side people who matter are on.
Yes, I think that's right. I think Trump's been fortunate to have the stock market stay frothy. But I feel like I keep waiting for the other shoe to drop. Somebody pointed out, I think, and it's very funny to imagine, is that Varn and I and other people have been looking at the political economy of commercial real estate since the rise of like work from home, since the pandemic. It seems like, you know, like somehow these balls are being juggled that like because commercial real estate holders are not selling anything right now, like true prices can't be recognized. So like the whole commercial real estate market is being held up by like ignorance and like people trying to close their eyes to what things are actually worth as like vacancy rates have remained high as like malls close down around the country. But one of the things that Musk says he's going to do through the powers anointed upon him by President Trump is to lease out or sell millions of square feet of like federal government offices. Like as he throws USAID and other government agencies into the wood chipper, they're also going to be selling the commercial real estate out from under there.
I guess
so. Imagine the theory, that tanks the commercial real estate.
But I guess is the theory that like we're going to privatize those functions, and so that's those spaces will be bought up by sort of like vassal, a vassal deep state that's like independent, you know, private but private public, you know, deep state.
I mean, the 20, 30 years ago, you would have had George W. Bush or like the old conservative coalition would have said like churches and community groups would do these things. But now we don't even believe in that anymore. I feel like part of the destructive like wood chipper shit is that these people don't actually believe that these functions have to happen, or that like somehow society is just going to figure out a way to make them happen without the government doing anything about it. And I feel like that's fundamentally not true. I feel like that's something you're getting at with like throwing up the possibility of people going homeless, generals not being paid, of like a general financial crisis. Like I truly think part of the radicalism of this moment is that Trump to an extent, but more so like Musk and these people don't even really realize what they're doing. Like they are poking at and prodding at things that like haven't been poked at in a really long time. And the consequences, you know, are great for them taking all of these societal functions that exist right now in the state within capitalist society to like smooth out the rough edges of accumulation and labor markets or whatever the case may be. Just gutting those things, just throwing people into the street, is going to lead to some serious consequences. And I'm not saying they're going to redound to in our favor anytime soon, but they're going to like cause a sort of social chaos that none of us are going to be immune to.
Right. Yeah.
When the generals are out of work, when the commercial real estate market finally does collapse because you've dumped like 10 million square feet of product on it because all the federal facilities are all of a sudden like privatized and sold, you know, you're looking at a moment of severe chaos where we don't know what the consequences are going to be.
And, you know, maybe this will be a good transition behind the paywall, but it's interesting to look at Trump's floated trade war and its postponement.
Oh, yeah.
So if you want to hear that discussion, please support the show at patreon.com/theantifada. You can sign up for $5 a month. You can sign up for free. We have some membership episodes. Or you could really help us out and sign up for the year at $50 or $100 with a 17% discount. Patreon.com/theantifada.
And just for a taste of what you'll get on the other side, I came up with a great bon mot. You know, if Hegel said...
Bon mot, whatever.
However the fuck you say it. I've only read it. I've never heard anyone say it before. No one says that shit. Bon mot was...
I think so.
Yeah. If Hegel said that Napoleon was history on horseback, I'm saying that Elon Musk is history on horse tranquilizers. See you on the other side, folks. Right now.